Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and thank you for joining us at our new time, 1 to 3 in the afternoon. Yesterday, the Army gave Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi a 48-hour ultimatum to solve the country's crisis. He said he would stick to his national reconciliation plan. Of course, we're 24 hours away now from that ultimatum. Egypt's state news agency reported that early today, the foreign minister has submitted his resignation, joining five other ministers who have already reportedly resigned over the political crisis. On Sunday, millions rallied nationwide. We'll find out in a moment what the rallies have been like today, because there is a reporter on the ground who will be joining us momentarily. Large protests have continued. Cairo's Muslim Brotherhood headquarters were stormed and ransacked, and Morsi's opponents have accused him of putting the Brotherhood's interests ahead of the country's as a whole. All of this has developed, as you know, pretty quickly. He became Egypt's first Islamist president on June 30th, 2012, just a year ago, after winning free and fair elections following the 2011, 2 years ago, a revolution that toppled Hosni Mubarak. We have two guests with us this hour to talk about all that's happening in that country. Sharif Abdul Kaddush is an Egyptian-American journalist based in Cairo. He is a correspondent for Democracy Now! And a fellow also at the Nation Institute. Sharif Abdul Kaddush, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yes, thank you. Also joining us is Josh Stacher. He's assistant professor of political science at Kent State University, author of several articles about the Arab Spring in the New York Times and Middle East Report, and he's author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. Professor Stacher, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Sharif, let's start with you. If you could, I know you're in Cairo right now. Give us an understanding of what's been happening today. Have there been massive protests once again?
Well, I'm actually not far. I'm at a pro-Morsi rally, which is just a couple of miles from the presidential palace, where an anti-Morsi rally is being held. Both sides are coming out in big numbers today as we come, you know, we're less than 24 hours away from that deadline that the military gave yesterday, in vague terms, saying that political parties have to meet what they call people's demands, otherwise they would set some kind of roadmap for transition. Earlier today, Morsi met with the head of the army. We have yet to see what will come out of that. What is noticeable is that despite the fact that what's called the June 30th coalition, which the grassroots group called Tamarroads, which gained all these petitions, it says it has 22 million petitions calling for withdrawal of confidence from the president, and it was the first group to call for the June 30th protests. As delegated Mohamed al-Barada as its negotiator and representative, and he wasn't involved in any talks. So, you know, these are talks that are happening between the army and the presidency, and it must be said that large portions of this anti-Morsi contingent have warmly embraced the military's intervention, some openly calling for the military to intervene. When helicopters flew overhead, they wildly cheered as a show of support for the army. And it's, you know, these negotiations are happening and the army sees itself as representing the people, then I think that's a troubling development. You know, there's no great options right now for Egypt going forward. We're talking about military intervention into civilian politics in a very insidious way that could set a precedent going forward for many, many years. And also, we don't know how the Brotherhood is going to respond to this. The presidency itself issued a statement very late last night saying that it rejected the army's statement, saying that it wasn't told of it before it was issued, and saying that it wants to, quote-unquote, protect the legitimacy of its presidency.
Mm-hmm. Sharif, is it your understanding that the military would like to step in and seize power? We've been hearing in this country conflicting reports about that desire.
Well, it's, from what the military statement says, it issued a second statement saying that, clarifying, saying it wasn't a military coup. And by most accounts, I don't think the military wants to exactly be at the helm of power. We have to remember that it did take power after Mubarak's ouster and led the transition for a year and a half. a very badly mismanaged and troubling and turbulent transition, which led to many of the problems that we're witnessing today in Egypt. They were also involved in mass violence, none more so than the killing of 27 people in Cairo on October 9th, 2011. They put 12,000 civilians on military trials, and their image was severely tarnished in a year and a half. And when they handed power to Morsi a year ago, Morsi, a couple of months later, in August, issued a constitutional declaration and took back a lot of state power that they had tried to keep. And that was applauded by and celebrated by many people. And now it's amazing just that, you know, a year later, people are, generally many of these people who did vote for Morsi are openly calling for the military to intervene, to oust him from power. And the presidency itself is looking increasingly isolated. Cabinet ministers have resigned, six of them. Two of his spokespeople have resigned today. Even the leading, the largest ultra-conservative Salafi party, the Noor Party, which came in second in parliamentary elections, has backed calls for early presidential elections.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, this is the result of the Brotherhood acting in a winner-take-all manner after winning elections and not engaging in any kind of consensual or inclusive political process. And that's why we're in this crisis that we are in right now.
A year, Professor Stature, doesn't seem like a very long period of time for anybody to govern. Was Morsi doing things that were just completely things that kept many Egyptians appalled at the government? How could things change so rapidly?
Well, I mean, first off, let me say that I completely agree with the analysis that Sharif has put forward, that absolutely that the Muslim Brotherhood confirmed many of the suspicions about the organization when Mohamed Morsi became president and then started to govern in what was, you know, a blatantly partisan manner that alienated huge numbers of people that were voting for him. But I think we have to be incredibly nuanced here in our understanding that there was a machinery that the Muslim Brotherhood stepped into. They were not operating with free choice. They were not operating without, you know, the heavy weight of some baggage over top of them. And, you know, most of the Morsi issued two constitutional declarations, you know, taking back, you know, some of the powers from the military in August of 2011. But then again, also issuing one in November of 2012 that really was the breaking point. And it confirmed to many people that they, you know, were not to be trusted with power. But if you look at why Morsi had to do that constitutional declaration, is that the courts kept challenging him on basically every measure. The courts were seen as very friendly to the military. The military had basically designed a transition in which that they not only you know, their power, their state power grew, but they kind of got to be this arbitrating force.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the things that were put into the Constitution that was really rushed through and passed, you know, embarrassingly overnight, like 2 a.m. in the morning and things, were really expanded the military's ability to intervene. So, you know, the Morsi, I don't want to make him a sympathetic figure. He's made many, many mistakes. But he was also undoing, you know, a world of complications that the military themselves injected into this post-Mubarak transition. And then, you know, the last thing we also kind of, if we want to add another level of complexity to this, is that there was a machinery of, you know, perceiving or conceptualizing Islamists and what they do that was up and running for 30 years in the Mubarak regime. And you know, not only in Egypt, but even in, you know, the United States with, you know, the famous Edward Derigian comment back in 1992, how Islamists are only about one man, one vote, one time, right? So there's a conceptualization that's way bigger than anything that Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood could have brought in. And so you really have huge swaths and segments of the population that are just intensely skeptical about the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, this is a real sort of crossroads or a real sort of confluence of sort of disasters,
mm-hmm.
Where the brothers basically behaved in a way that many of their opponents or detractors said that they would. Mm. And so it doubled the problems from Morsi's perception.
And yet I remember Sharif doing shows on this about a year ago when some analysts were saying the Muslim Brotherhood is not to be feared. They have the interests of the poor at heart. They're feeding people. And don't worry about what may happen here. They're not a negative force in Egypt. Were people just misguided? Did they not see what the truth was? Or how could everybody have been so wrong?
Well, no. I mean, the Brotherhood has a legitimate and large base. For many years, they fulfilled, they acted as a group that fulfilled many of the functions that the state did not. The welfare state didn't, so, you know, they provided schools and hospitals, soup kitchens and things like that, and they had a large, broad-based support network. But I think once they got into power, that didn't translate into great governance. And, you know, they really didn't reach out at all to other political groups. I agree with Josh, absolutely. They faced an uphill battle. There was state institutions like the judiciary, the Ministry of Interior, that were very difficult to work with and were, you know, long-time enemies of the Muslim Brotherhood. But I would have to say that many people who support what we call the revolution, voted for Morsi in the runoff against Ahmed Shafiq, who was a stalwart of the former regime. And if you look, you know, for the first few months of his rule, there was not much protest against Morsi. It was really in November when he issued that constitutional declaration that placed all his decisions outside of the reach of the judiciary and so forth. So we saw the first uprising against him. We saw the first clashes between, real serious clashes, where 10 people were killed between Brotherhood supporters and opponents at the presidential palace. And since then, it's been a very chaotic ride.
Mm-hmm.
There has been no reform of the security apparatus or the police whatsoever. It's essentially the same institution it was under Mubarak. Morsi has repeatedly thanked the police and thanked the army, despite you know, leaks of a report from a fact-finding commission that he himself put together that found that the police and army engaged in torture and abuse during the revolution. So these are the kinds of issues that have come into play. And just finally, I'd like to add, despite this situation now with the military being involved, I would argue that what is happening now is still a very revolutionary moment. Being on the streets here on June 30th, I've covered, you know, as many protests as I can in these 2.5 years. I never saw something that big. It was really a mass mobilization by different Egyptians, different walks of life. And I think if you look at these trends of people taking to the streets, it shows that there is a rejection of authoritarianism ever since this revolution began. It first rejected Hosni Mubarak and threw him out of office. It then rejected the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, the military that led. And now it is rejecting Morsi because he has acted in the same way. He's acted as basically a more legitimate, that is to say, a more freely elected form of the old regime.
Mm-hmm.
But he has not sought to reform the regime whatsoever. So, you know, I think this is what happens. These mass mobilizations keep happening because to try and change this paternalistic style of governance in Egypt, people will not accept that anymore.
And Sharif, there is a rejection of authoritarianism and a call for what?
Well, this is where it gets complicated. There's a call. I mean, a lot of the people on the streets are calling for the military to intervene because they see that as the only way out right now. There's a call for change. For, you know, a lot of the people are just ordinary Egyptians whose lives have become harder. Food prices have gone up. Medicine prices have gone up. Unemployment has gone up. Insecurity and vigilante violence has spread. You know, there's electricity blackouts now in the summer months. They've become a daily part of life. There's fuel shortages and there's these long lines at the gas station that cause crippling traffic jams across the country. So their lives have not improved in any way. And they want to see some kind of change. For many revolutionaries, they want to see some kind of justice and accountability from those in power. We've had over 1,000 people killed. No one is behind bars for these crimes. Activists and journalists keep getting arrested and thrown behind bars for displaying dissent. So it's these kinds of, I think, factors that come into play. And it must be said, there are elements of the former regime that are looking to hijack this mass mobilization and return, you know, their former return to their former seats of power and oust the Brotherhood, whom they're long enemies of.
Ooh, another level of complexity to all of this. Do you want to add anything to that, Professor Thatcher? Do you see the calls for something other than authoritarianism as somewhat vague or not?
I mean, look, whenever you have a mass mobilization, the demands are always a bit vague. But the original demands of the protests back in 2011 were bread, freedom, and social justice. And, you know, we've had 17 months of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces governance. We've had 12 months of the Muslim Brotherhood rule. And what we've gotten was a bunch of personnel shifts at the top where they've tried to placate and dilute the energies of the mobilization by saying, okay, we'll give you somebody new at the top. When in fact, what people are asking for when they say bread, freedom, and social justice is they want substantial reform to the ways and the practices of how the state interacts with its citizens. And so, I mean, I don't think it's that sort of mesmerizing that we keep seeing these mobilizations because, if anything, it's incredibly special that they continue to go on in the face of all the counter-revolutionary behavior that not only the old regime has, you know, consistently and persistently kept up, but also sort of like these new agents to sort of governance, like the Muslim Brotherhood, who basically joined the old regime coalition and said, okay, we can win elections, but we're not really going to change our style of governance. And at the head of this is really the sort of Egyptian armed forces, who seem intent on carving out and establishing. And I agree with Sharif, they don't want to govern directly. They want to be on top of the political system with the ability to intervene and the ability to arbitrate the flow and trajectory of Egyptian politics. And there's very good reasons for why they want to do this. They want to maintain their influence, and they want to maintain their economic empires, which are, incredibly large. So, and they are the sort of chief conduit to the U.S.-Egyptian relationship. The armed forces here, really are leading the sort of counter-revolutionary, wave, and it's just shocking that so many, newer politicians that have been introduced to this order are so willing to jump on the bandwagon. Had they acted differently and had they actually sided with the people in the street, I think that the mobilization would have, decreased, but it hasn't because they haven't changed their behavior.
We're talking about Egypt this hour of our program. Yesterday, the army giving the Egyptian president a 48-hour ultimatum to solve the crisis in the country, which is quite substantial, and we're finding out just how substantial it is this hour of the show. Sharif Abdul Kaddush will be with us for a few more minutes. He's on the ground in Cairo, and he's been covering all that's been going on in Egypt for 2.5 years now. He's an Egyptian-American journalist based in Cairo, correspondent for Democracy Now!, and a fellow at the Nation Institute. Professor Josh Stacher with us for the whole hour, professor of political science at Kent State University. Our phone number, if you would like to join our conversation, and we would like to hear from you, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Egypt this hour of the program and welcoming calls for our guests. 800-486-8655 is the number. Carl in Madison, hello.
Hello. You've become very faint, but I assume I'm coming in loud and clear.
Yes, you are.
I'm curious about the Minister of Defense to hold his position in the first place. I would assume he holds some sway with the military. I wonder if he's resigned or is still in office, and I wonder if he has a plan to a hand to play in this whole situation.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. Sharif?
I'm afraid, could you repeat part of that question? I didn't hear it exactly. I'm sorry.
The Minister of Defense, has he resigned? Does he have anything to say about what's going on?
No, well, the Minister of Defense is the head of the Army. He's the one who issued the statement yesterday. So, he's the one who's initiating this intervention into civilian politics. And, you know, there's word now, or there's been reports that the army is going to deploy troops at the presidential palace at Tahrir to, quote-unquote, protect protesters or prevent any kind of clashes. There's been sporadic violence that's been occurring throughout the country. 24 people have died in the past week or so in these clashes. We have to understand it's hard to know exactly what's going to come out of this. There's several options. There's one that Morsi is ousted outright by the military and some kind of interim cabinet or interim president takes charge until a new constitution and new elections can be held. There's been a talk of a referendum, a national referendum on Morsi's presidency to see whether he should stay or go. There's been talk of Morsi staying in power and having presidential elections, early presidential elections in 6 months. I think what's important to realize is that any process going forward, it's important that the Muslim Brotherhood is included in that process. If they're excluded from the political sphere, then we're going to have instability for many years to come because they are a legitimate, broad-based group here in Egypt. And if they have no say in politics going forward, that can only mean instability going forward.
Mm-hmm. Sharif, thank you very, very much for being with us on an incredibly busy and difficult day, I'm sure. Thank you. Sharif Abdul Kaddush, Egyptian-American. He is based in Cairo. He's a journalist, of course, correspondent for Democracy Now! And a fellow at the Nation Institute. Josh Stacher remaining with us, assistant professor of political science at Kent State University. Professor Thatcher, we're looking at this deadline, which is now less than 24 hours away. What's going to happen 24 hours from now in Egypt?
That is a great question, and no one knows the answer. I mean, I think Sharif laid out some very plausible, you know, scenarios. One is that, you know, Morsi is sort of deposed. One is that there's some sort of national, you know, referendum on whether he stays or goes. One is that they keep Morsi around but more or less force him to be more inclusive in terms of who's in his government, who he consults with. But, you know, none of these options are good. And the options, I think, that the defense minister El-Sisi laid out when he put down this ultimatum that he later came out and said this is not a coup, basically, you know, kind of speak to that difficulty in a sense that, you know, there's no good options for the Muslim Brotherhood at this point. Because even if Morsi would stay some way, somehow, I am of the belief that it was a coup because he will never be able to be an effective president, and he's never going to be listened to by a sizable majority of his population. I mean, the military completely emasculated him yesterday. And so, you know, but at the same time, it's unclear that Sisi wants to take over, that SCAF would like to return to power. I don't think that's the case. As I mentioned earlier, I think they want to be this arbitrator of politics. And so, you know, I think that this is sort of being designed as we go along, so to say. But I also agree with Sharif. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood hasn't really. I think they've handled this sort of ultimatum. There's two ways they could have handled it, right? One, they could have packed their bags and they could have kind of went off and cried and said, like, look, we were victimized. We won the election. We were ousted in a coup. This was ridiculous. But they opted for, you know, plan B, which was they dug their heels in and they started mobilizations around the country. And now there's violence breaking out in parts of Cairo and around the country. And so, you know, I mean, I think that the Muslim Brotherhood understood that ultimatum yesterday as an existential threat to whether they are going to be able to continue to operate in an open and legitimate fashion, above board, legal, or if we're going back to the old days of the Mubarak regime when they were arbitrarily sort of rounded up and thrown in jail, you know, on charges like, you know, belonging to a banned organization or, you know, whatever the political charge of the day was.
I believe I read that they are out in much greater numbers today than in earlier days of this protest, the Muslim Brotherhood. Are you hearing that as well, that they're on the streets in large numbers today?
They are on the streets in large numbers. I've heard that they've told the rank and file they're not to be speaking to journalists. And the leaders that are speaking with journalists, you know, from what we're reading in news accounts and journalists that are publishing what they're what kind of quotes they're getting on Twitter, you know, they all are under the impression, or there's an overwhelming majority that are under the impression that the Muslim Brotherhood is just being defined. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so if that's the case, you know, if they make this a zero-sum game, and you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is responding to making it a zero-sum game. The military actually made it, initiated the zero-sum game. But if we're going to have a zero-sum game, then I imagine, well, it's very rare in any country in the world that an elected president in an election that has 52% of the population turning out gets removed from power that we don't see bloodshed.
And it's pretty soon after he was elected, right? We're only talking a year. Are you convinced that those elections were completely free and fair?
Oh, yeah, they were absolutely free and fair. I was an election monitor.
Oh, you were?
Oh, yeah, for a major election monitoring center. And I was deployed in a part of the country. And so I knew the other election monitors. We all talked. Now, I'll say this. There is a caveat to that statement. The procedural aspects of the presidential elections and the parliamentary elections were free and fair. People that came in with their IDs, were on the roll, were allowed to cast a ballot. The ballots were counted properly. The results were reported correctly. The context and the conditions under which those elections took place were a bit suspect and, you know, weren't actually sort of free and fair because of the military's presence, because of who was allowed to write the electoral laws. It advantaged some groups over other groups and so forth. So, you know, the British have this lovely saying, right, only amateurs rig elections on election day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you wanted to subscribe to the idea that the SCAF was this, you know, evil genius-type calculating machine, you know, they designed a system in which they kind of understood who was going to kind of rise in that system and who was going to be marginalized. So the protesters, the revolutionaries would be marginalized. The more established groups that had kind of acquiesced and accepted the norms of the old regime were the ones that rose. And then what they did is they disemboweled the entire process by doing these constitutional declarations. So it didn't matter if Mohamed Morsi, Ahmed Shafiq, or Mickey Mouse became president. There was absolutely no way that they could threaten the military's authority.
That's
so
I'm
the
sorry.
Elections were free and fair, however.
Right. However. Jay in Appleton, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for the program, and thank you for your guest. I had a question about my understanding is the military budget is several billions from the United States. And with that in mind, what role our government has in kind of leading the military to these sorts of decisions and exerting the power over the legitimate president? Thank you.
Thank you.
Take my answer up there.
All right, Jay.
That's a great question and an incredibly complex one. So the origins of the U.S.-Egyptian relationship actually go back to the years of Anwar Sadat when he unilaterally, and by unilateral I mean basically himself breaking away from his political establishment, signed the peace agreement with Israel in 1979, the Camp David Accords. In exchange for signing the Camp David Accords and switching over from the USSR to the United States sort of camp during the Cold War, he was rewarded with around $2.1 billion worth a year. $1.3 of that billion a year was military aid, and the rest of it came in economic aid and social aid. Over the years, the economic and social aid has diminished each year. So now, but the military aid has remained constant. So they have received, you know, $1.3 billion for the military every year since 1979. Now, it's a little bit of a red herring because something like 80 or 85% of that money ends up coming back to the United States and to our defense production industries. So, you know, I live in Ohio, you know, Lima, Ohio, right? It's this, like, town where they produce the Abrams A1A tanks. Like, they supply all those to Egypt, right? So that military aid is actually going into Lima, Ohio. It doesn't actually ever hit Cairo. And so, you know, that, but the economic aid has been, you know, trimmed over the years. So, but still, you know, we're talking about, you know, Egypt being the second largest recipient of aid behind Israel. since 1979. And, you know, so what this does is this allows their generals to talk to our generals. And there's extensive overlap. There's the Bright Star, you know, exercises that happen every other year. The United States and Egypt worked together during the Gulf War in 1991 against Saddam Hussein. I mean, Mubarak proved to be a staunch ally. The military is very pro-friendly to the United States, is very pro-U.S. They're very friendly to the United States. And so, you know, when we talk about U.S. policy to Egypt, we tend to focus on, like, what the White House is thinking or what the State Department's saying
yes.
or what Congress is talking about. But no one ever really talks about what that Pentagon-shaped building is thinking or what they're talking about and how they have influential inputs into U.S. policy creation in Egypt. And that's why, you know, we see every time this comes up in Congress, like, well, they're not really Democrats. Like, why should we give them the aid? You know, Obama pulls out the national security waiver. And it's not just Obama. I mean, you know, pick your U.S. president since Sadat was in power.
Mm-hmm.
There is bipartisan support for, you know, Egypt, the relationship with Egypt and funding Egypt. And sometimes that comes irrespective of what type of governance is actually in place. I mean, Hosni Mubarak was around for six U.S. presidents.
I believe President Obama had a telephone conversation with President Morsi sometime today. Do you know what the substance of that conversation was?
Yeah, I mean, well, I read the readout that they've issued from that. You know, essentially, Obama has been very sort of upfront in saying, like, look, this is an Egyptian process. We're not picking winners and losers. We would love to work with an elected government. We believe in democracy. You know, that would be where they're hedging. Many Egyptians are taking that as like a sign that, you know, maybe they're supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. But if the military takes over tomorrow, then the Muslim Brotherhood is going to accuse the Obama administration of, you know, backing the military. And, you know, the best way to kind of understand the U.S. position to Egypt is to kind of completely drop the democratization frame lens entirely. The United States is not interested in the business of democracy in the Middle East and in Egypt. They're interested in the business of who can exercise political authority, who can keep stability, and who can protect U.S. interests. So if that's an elected government, it's the Muslim Brotherhood, then that's fine. The greatest example of that is when Morsi was instrumental in helping get the ceasefire agreement between Hamas and Israel back in November of last year, 2012. And, I mean, you know, the New York Times, you know, had an interview with Obama the next day, and it was practically a love letter to Morsi.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, the United States is not ideological about Islamists or ideological about military governance. They view the world as a map that of areas of spheres of influence and control, and you know, places that promote U.S. interests and places that don't.
Mm-hmm. So
Egypt
you,
will side with whatever side is doing that.
So go a little further. U.S. interest in Egypt would be what?
Oh, the peace treaty with Israel, Camp David. It eliminates the largest Arab army from, you know, going to war with Israel, passage through the Suez Canal, which, of course, you know, I don't know what the numbers are, but, you know, given the U.S. military activity in the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Gulf, Iraq, Afghanistan, all those ships go through the Suez Canal, right? So, and they get priority service going through the canal. You know, then there's the issue of overflights. The Egyptian government grants the United States military something like 400 to 500 overflights a year.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, there's lots of reasons. And then, of course, you know, back in the old days of the Mubarak regime, I mean, whatever the United States position was in the Middle East, Mubarak was going to support it, even if it flew crazily into the face of public resistance and public opinion. So, you know, I think that, you know, Morsi has also kind of done that, right? There's been some scares, like, will Morsi warm up to the Iranians, or, you know, what's Morsi's position on Syria? And you know, frankly, I mean, they haven't really broken away from the sort of client status that existed under the Mubarak years, but it does look a lot different. And this is actually, you know, another thing that we could add to the list that Sharif and I spoke about earlier about things that haven't really changed, right? Nobody that's protesting wants to kind of like declare war on the United States. They want a relationship that is, you know, nation to nation, state to state, peer to peer, as opposed to like, you know, patron client. And so, you know, that hasn't been addressed either. And that was, you know, a key demand.
Mm-hmm. We welcome more phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. As you know, there is a whole lot going on in Egypt these days. Just in the last couple days, actually, massive demonstrations, 22 million signatures collected asking for the resignation of President Morsi, who was just elected a year ago, asking for new presidential elections or else facing a campaign of civil disobedience. There is some question about what role the military is playing in all of this and whether or not there could be a coup in the next 24 hours. So we're looking at all of it this hour of our program. Our guest is Professor Josh Stacher, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Kent State University. Feel free to join our conversation with any questions you may have or special understanding that you may have of Egypt and what's going on and what your concerns are. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Egypt this hour, welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Let's talk just a little bit, please, Professor Stacher, about the role of religion in all of this, because it seems to find its way in other uprisings taking place in countries like Turkey in the Middle East. Has there been too much religion in the Morsi government? What has Islamist rule meant? And are some of the protests in response to that, wanting a more secular society, or is that not a part of what's going on?
First off, religion is a massive, important part of Egyptian society. And, but I think that we have to understand religion in very nuanced ways. Religion isn't driving or dictating what's going on here. It's more of a product of the sort of political, social, and economic, you know, structures that guide Egyptians' lives. So, you know, there is a fundamental way, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is a religious organization, but it's also like a social organization. So, you know, the way that we like to explain this is that, the Boy Scouts was founded in 1912. Their slogan is Be Prepared, of course. The Muslim Brotherhood was founded in 1928. Their slogan, Be Prepared. And what was the Muslim Brotherhood? It was a social organization that was about teaching good civic behavior. It was about being sort of pious in sort of like that, a sense of like, you know, there are good values that come from religion. It was a sports organization. It was a social outreach organization. And so, you know, a lot of people get attracted to political Islam. One, because the networks of this old state weren't open to them because of the patron-client relations of the NDP,
mm-hmm.
And they were open over at the Muslim Brotherhood. Or, you know, when the state underwent economic restructuring and neoliberal reforms starting in the 1980s and 1990s, the state withdrew from many parts of the country, and the Muslim Brotherhood was really good at filling those gaps. So it's very difficult to kind of know when someone is supporting that organization because they are so religiously, fixated, like that's why they're doing it, or is it because of all these other sort of day-to-day life issues that win them support? And just to give you sort of an idea of how complicated this is, right, if you look at the countries of the Middle East, everyone but Israel is predominantly Muslim, and most of the Sunni states have some sort of Muslim Brotherhood organization. They all look different. And the reason they look different is because of the context in which they operate. And secondly, you know, there's no sort of monolithic group. So, like, groups like the Jamaa Islamiyya, which are a little bit more conservative than the Muslim Brotherhood, or the Salafi Noor Party, which is more conservative than them, they look at the Muslim Brotherhood and they say, you know what, you guys aren't even Islamist. You guys are obsessed with power. You guys are obsessed with, like, you know, winning elections. Like, you're not even doing the right thing. So, you know, I think that it's pretty dangerous to break these protesters up into secular versus religion, because on the streets, in reality, those distinctions don't actually matter. I mean, the fact of the matter is most Egyptians, like most Americans, you know, tend to believe in God, tend to be religious. And then, you know, a lot less people that from that segment actually go to church or go to mosque or, you know, one of these things. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So it's not like England where like 7% of the population goes to church,
mm-hmm.
right? So religion is involved, but it's often a means of expressing discontent or expressing political wills, as opposed that couch, you know, demands injustice and whatnot, as opposed to like being purely, literally, Islamically inspired, so to speak.
Hmm. It's hard, as you say that, though, to imagine any groups who have not been obsessed with power once they have power, right?
Absolutely, right? And this is what makes the game universal, and this is what makes it interesting.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere I was reading today, and I'm not sure what this means, but I want to give it to you, and maybe you'll have some explanation to what it means. The protests maybe sending a message to other Islamist groups around the region in the aftermath of the Arab Spring of how the Brotherhood is tainting Islamism.
I think that, you know, on some very, very general level, that may be true. But as I mentioned, you know, every country is different. Every country has a different context. Some things float in the sort of Syrian context that would never float in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, the Islamists have enjoyed some sort of popularity largely because they haven't been in power. Once you put them into the seats of power and they actually have their hands on the levers of state, they're going to start generating some discontent because somebody's going to get marginalized and excluded.
And finally, we have time for a little more. I'm trying to understand more fully what it is, what's on the list of demands that the people want. They want new elections immediately. They want Morsi out. Is there a specific list of desires?
There is no specific list because the protests are so, you know, multifarious in terms of who's making them up and composing them and all the rest of these things. But, you know, I mean, you know, again, I know they're general demands, but if we break it down, bread, freedom, and social justice, I mean, people want the economy to be better. People want to be, you know, have more freedom. So, you know, things like they don't want to be tortured arbitrarily for going down the street at the wrong time at the wrong place and a police officer picks on them and asks for a bribe. And if they don't get the bribe, they're taken to the police station and then, you know, handcuffed and electrocuted.
Ew. That's awful.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very repressive political system, and this is one reason why it's generating so much response. So, you know, specific lists of demands, you know, the use of torture is sort of, it's bad, right? So, you know, in social justice, Egypt has been undergoing neoliberal economic reform. It really accelerated after 2004, and the growth rates in the country were something like 7%. Which by international financial institution matrix are like, you know, heavenly. They love this stuff. Egypt was winning like top performer. But, you know, we know from the WikiLeaks releases that when Ambassador Margaret Scobie was in Cairo, she actually wrote a cable back to Washington that literally says something to the effect that, like, economic reform has been a success story here. It's too bad that 35 to 40% of the population lives in remedial poverty.
Mm.
And by that, she meant less than $2 a day.
Oh, my.
So, you know, I mean, yeah, they're not concrete demands that we can point to and say, okay, you need to do A, B, and C. But, you know, the population does not feel like the practices of the regime have changed and that, you know, we're making any progress. People will believe in hope, and they'll believe in the hope of change. But, you know, you have to give them some tangibles or else, you're going to end up peeling people away from that coalition that you build, the rhetorical coalition you build. And the problem is the elites in Egypt, whether it was the old Mubarak regime, whether it was the military, whether it's some of the sort of so-called secular politicians or whether it's the Islamist politicians, the closer they get to the institutions of state and the state apparatus, the less likely they are to actually carry out these improvements.
Mm-hmm.
And that really speaks to a systematic problem in Egypt, and that is that the state apparatus, the machinery of state, the bureaucrats, the ways that people get controlled, like the security forces and so forth, have not been touched.
And yet,
until you touch those, you're going to have continual mobilization.
And yet it must have been something that President Morsi knew he had to do when he became president, right? You've got to feed people. You've got to make sure they have jobs. You've got to keep the economy going or people are down and out.
Absolutely. So, I mean, here again is this sort of, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the chicken and egg thing about Morsi, you know, what starts what, in a sense that when Morsi was elected with 52% of the vote against Ahmed Shafiq's 48, with 52% of the population turning out in clean elections, the night that the ballots were being counted, the military issued a constitutional declaration basically saying Morsi had zero power.
Hmm.
And the military the courts had disbanded parliament. And so Morsi was in this position where, you know, he came to power, he was incredibly weak. He was on an island, and, you know, you don't think Mohamed Morsi hates the security forces? I know from just my own interactions with you know, before he was president, Mohamed Morsi, I mean, he was thrown in prison several times because he was the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood despises the security services. But guess what? It's not so easy when you become president and you're weak and you have this, you know, draconian sort of military standing over top of you that it can depose you with an ultimatum as they're dropping, like, Egyptian flags out of military helicopters flying over crowds. It's not that easy to kind of, like, disband your security forces and rebuild them. Because, you know, there have been cases where the state apparatus has been fired, and it's led to an even crazier sort of insurrection, and that would be Iraq in 2003.
Right. It's hard to imagine, isn't it, Professor Stature, what would happen tomorrow if there were military intervention? It's fairly frightening.
I think it is frightening, and because it's been turned into a zero-sum game, and the Brotherhood is scared that they're going to go back into the shadows or back into the mm-hmm. jail cells. I mean, they may fight, and you know, Sharif is absolutely right. They're a legitimate block of the population, and while there's a lot of Egyptians that are saying, like, recognize this and say that they have to be included in a post-Morsi presidency, there's also a huge amount of Egyptians that don't care and would rather them be repressed and thrown back into the torture chambers. And so, you know, what we're getting at is a sort of situation that has no good outcomes for the population that is protesting and wanting change, for, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, but, you know, the only group that's going to sort of benefit in all this chaos and destruction is going to be the Egyptian military. Why? Because they're going to maintain the ability to intervene in civilian politics whenever they feel like things are getting a little out of hand, even though they don't do anything to actually help bolster the situation. And you know, they're the ones that set up the Morsi presidency to fail. Morsi just came by and behaved in a manner that sped up the failure.
Thank you ever so much for being with us to explain a complicated and important situation in the world today. We appreciate your time and your expertise, Professor.
Anytime. It was my pleasure.
Thanks. Professor Josh Stature, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Kent State University. He's written extensively about the Arab Spring for the New York Times and Middle East Report and has authored books as well. We thank him for his time. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the show and Rhonda Fanning as well. We want to let you know that tomorrow at this time, our guest will be Kevin Blyer. He has a new book. It's a parody, Me and the People, or One Man's Selfless Quest to Rewrite the Constitution of the United States of America. Kevin will be with us, Comedy Central writer and producer, so we'll have some fun. Second half hour, Peter Isley will join us. We'll be discussing the recent revelations surrounding the Archdiocese of Milwaukee and what it means to survivors of those abused by priests. That will be tomorrow, full first hour tomorrow. Thanks for listening to this hour. More to come right after the latest news.